This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the more recent and increasingly popular forms of theater is the autobiographical monologue. My guest Henry Rollins may strike you as an unlikely candidate for this kind of performance because he comes from the world of punk rock, where vocals usually had more to do with aggressive attitude than narrative development. But believe me, he's awfully good at his talking performances. Rollins first became known as the vocalist with Black Flag. Reviewing his spoken word show for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Roberto Santiago wrote, "What makes Rollins a remarkable performance artist is his ability to instantly bring insight and humor into tragic events without coming off as a preachy educator or a rehearsed nightclub comic." Rollins' talk performances have been released by Imago Records. I asked him about the difference between performing with his band and standing on stage alone telling stories.
Well, with the music, it's usually a very humorless, very violent, explosive affair. And with the spoken word, it tends to lend itself more towards smiling and laughing and enjoyment like that.
So it brings out different parts of your personality?
Yeah, well, you know, you lock a mere mortal in a room with a band on 11 and a bunch of people sweating and, you know, what's he supposed to do? Sit there and act like he's, you know, going to the dentist or something. I mean, there's different levels of excitement, and I don't go out and do talking shows and stand there and jump up and down and scream. So, you know, the talking shows tend to be a bit more low-key in some ways, like overall volume.
Mm-hmm.
But the intensity is pretty much the same level both times.
You're the kind of person who would definitely stand out in a crowd, just visually even. You have enormous muscles from bodybuilding, a really kind of developed neck from bodybuilding. You have tattoos down your arm and the back of your neck and on your back. So I guess you'd have to be wearing at least a short-sleeve shirt to see some of this. Do strange things happen to you when you're in a group of people because of the way that you stand out?
Oh, well, yeah, people have been staring at me, looking at me funny since I was about 20 years old. So it's all right.
So how did you start bodybuilding?
Well, I don't do that. I just lift a lot of weights. There's a lot of, it's kind of a different approach. I lift for fitness and strength and, you know, because I like life. But I've been working out since I was about 14 on and off. But the last 4 or 5 years, mainly on, and in the last 5 years, it gets more and more to where now I go in about 6 days a week.
What are the tattoos you have on your arms?
All kinds of things. I mean, I know we're talking to people out there in radio land, but I don't know. There's lots of stuff. You know, it's not something I sit down and talk about. You know, some people feel the need to get tattoos. Obviously, in my case, it comes from some kind of insecurity where just being born wasn't good enough. I had to customize myself in a certain way. I guess perhaps as to not sort of not look like my mother and father or anyone else. And obviously working off an insecurity, as do most people who take the stage.
So have you often been kind of like singled out by either police or by punks because of the way you look?
I've been singled out by police in major cities all over the world at different times, which is too bad because I'm not a criminal type. You know, I don't do that which is illegal. You know, I don't hurt people or mug people or break into their homes or anything. So to walk the streets of Los Angeles and have a cop pull you over, you know, as you're walking and call you a bunch of names and threaten you is kind of hard to take.
Let me read a catchy quote of yours. "I was raised to hurt myself and hate myself." Would you explain that?
It's interesting that you said it's catchy.
Yeah.
Well, if I would have fully realized the vision my parents had set out for me, I would have turned into just the self-effacing and eventually self-erasing person, you know, who would cower and shake. I mean, spending time with my father was basically walking tiptoe on rice paper through a minefield. The mission was get through the weekend and don't get backhanded. You know, don't get smacked in public. Don't get whacked. that was how I used to deal with my dad. It was never about conversation or learning anything. It was just don't do the wrong thing and get belted. And so that kind of makes you kind of a fidgety, nervous person when you're young, and you get very prone to explosive violence and a lot of paranoia. And on my mother's side, there's just a lot of fear there, you know, a lot of fear with her boyfriends and just her tension that and her thing that she was going through. And, you know, to go do have all that and then go to an all-boys school at the same time and not be able to relate to women, although you wanted to. By the time I was 18, I was an extremely tense young man.
You went to a military school, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a naval preparatory school. They got people ready for the Naval Academy and West Point. And so all my teachers were ex-military, and there's a real emphasis on athletics and really hard education. And the teachers were allowed to whack the students. And I was on a lot of drugs at the time, not by my own will. It was Ritalin, you know, for hyperactivity.
Oh, I thought they just gave that to kids.
Yeah, they gave it to me till I was about in about 10th grade, and then I stopped taking it. I was on it from kindergarten up.
Let me get back to the military academy. How did you react to the strict discipline of military training?
Okay, well, it wasn't like we fell out with rifles every morning at 6 a.m., but, you know, it was a dress code that was adhered to, and there was detention, and, you know, you were told to, you know, stand up straight and all that. And it had a good effect on me. I mean, this discipline's a good thing to have. It gets you, you know, up in the morning and gets you where you need to go. My father instilled in me a lot of discipline, and I definitely think it's a virtue. If you notice, anyone who is successful or has traits that you admire, they're usually very disciplined.
How did you use that discipline on yourself? What did you discipline yourself to do?
Well, I always worked after school. You know, I always had money in my pocket because I always had a job. I was working since I was in fourth grade. And I'd work all through the weekend. And anything I was really interested in, I would go at with all speed. You know, I'd study. There's things I was actually interested in besides, you know, running around and, you know, riding a bike into a tree like most young kids. I read books. I read authors. I read about them. I learned about certain animal groups. I went to a pet shop and got a job there just so I could learn about snakes, you know. I had interests.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Henry Rollins, and he's a leader of the Henry Rollins Band and also does a lot of talking performances and has a series of audio cassettes and CDs called The Box Life, and has a video of one of his performances called Talking from the Box. So let's see. When you dropped out of college early on, right?
Yeah, I went for – started in 1979, I guess. And I just found it all very, very boring, you know. I was using my ninth grade math book. The students, my fellow students in the English class, were really stupid. And I said, I don't want to do this for 4 years.
So when you left college, what did you do with yourself?
I went out and got a job.
What kind of job?
I worked at an ice cream store. Went in because all my friends worked there. So I got a job there. And after the first day of work, I went to the boss and I said, well, you know, you should make me a manager of your store, a shift manager, because I can save you some money here. And I showed him a few different things. And he said, all right, wise guy, you work here 2 more weeks. And if you don't screw up, we'll make you a manager. If you screw up once, you're out of here. I said, that's a good deal. I think he liked me, you know. And so he made me a manager. Then I became the head manager. And then I pretty much started running the whole place, hiring, firing, inventory, deposits, had the keys to the whole place. I'd be there about 60 hours a week. And then I joined Black Flag and started this life of somewhat dubious celebrity.
Would you tell a story of how you joined the band?
Sure. I was always a fan of the band, and I lived in Washington, D.C., and they lived in Los Angeles. And they would come out to Washington, D.C., where I was living, and they would play, and they would sleep at my friend's house because they were these guys living in a van, and we'd all put them up and feed them and hang out. And they were very nice people, and I really liked the band. It really, they were saying what I wanted to say. You know, they had that rage that I was feeling. And I went to go up to go see them in New York of March of 81 because they were not playing in Washington. So I drove up to New York to see them, took a day off from my job. And they did an after-show party at this small club in the Village. So I went there with them, and they were playing away in this bar just for, like, you know, 50 people who just kind of heard the word and went down there. And I told the guys, I said, hey, you know, play the song Clocked In, which is a song about going to work, because I had to leave right from that club and drive down to D.C. and go to work. And I hadn't slept yet, so it was going to be a hard shift. So they said, all right, let's do Clocked In for Henry. And, you know, they started playing. And I kind of looked at the singer, Dez, and kind of looked at the microphone. And he said, here, take it. You know, just gave me the mic, and I just sang the song because I knew it. And everyone in the band was kind of looking at me going, wow, that was wild. And everyone in the crowd was kind of nodding their heads like, that sure was cool. And then I just didn't think anything more of it than, wow, I can tell my friends at home I did a song with Black Flag, man. That's pretty bitchin'. So I went, got in my car, went back down to Washington and worked. And later on that week, the guys in the band called me from New York and said, well, you know, we're auditioning new singers because our singer, Dez, wants to move down to rhythm guitar. And we really liked what you did the other night. Would you like to come up here and try it out? I went, yeah. So I took a train up there and, you know, sang two sets with them. What I knew I sang, what I didn't know I improvised. And I got in the band.
Why don't I play something from your one of your records with Black Flag?
All right.
Dallas, coward, ride the cold. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this score, what we say. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Try to stop what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't do it themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Way up high, up yours.
That's Black Flag with my guest Henry Rollins doing the vocals. When you were first performing with Black Flag, what were some of the things that the audience would do as you were performing?
Every physical move you could think as far as arms and legs moving around. Sometimes they would get a bit antagonistic. They would hurl objects at the singer's head, put themselves on stage and swing at my face, try and light certain parts of my anatomy on fire with Bic lighters. It was always an interesting adventure at every Black Flag show. Music was only part of it. It was...
Did you find yourself both liking and really detesting some of your fans?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that was the hard part about Black Flag. Some of the people at our shows, I wouldn't ever want to see again. I don't want to know them. You know, guys coming up and Sieg Heiling, you know, skinheads. Mm-hmm. I'm not into that kind of stuff.
Henry Rollins is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Henry Rollins. He's a writer, vocalist, leads the Rollins Band, and now he has several cassettes, CDs, called The Box Life of some of his talking performances. There's also a video of one of his talking performances. Let me ask you about something that happened last year, something really awful. Your very close friend of many years was killed, Joe Cole. You were with him, you had just rented a movie, and you were coming home to the house that you shared to watch it when you were held up. Would you tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, me and my pal Joe was coming home from the store, and these two guys came out of the bushes with guns, and they put them in our faces. They said, this is a hold up, and they held us up, and they said, we're gonna go into your house now. So I knew they were going to take us in and kill us. I mean, you know, just I could just see us having to go into the back room and, you know, put our heads on the floor and just get shot. So I just kind of, I don't know, I wasn't all that afraid. Not that I was all brave and was going to wrestle a gun away from someone. It was just like so factual that you just kind of went, oh, well, this is how it ends up, I guess, you know. I was terrified, but at the same time, you're just like, well, this is all happening so fast, you know. But the guy put the gun in my back, and I had the key, so I kind of led the way, and I had the three of them behind me, Joe and two gunmen. I opened the door, walked into the living room of the house, and put my groceries down and stuck my hands in the air and awaited further instruction. And I heard gunshots behind me, and the gunshots stopped, and I ran out the back of the house and ran up the alley and called the cops. And what had happened was the guy had shot Joe. Someone did. I mean, I my back turns. I don't know exactly the sequence of events, but from where I was standing and tracing where the bullets went, the guy shot at me twice and missed me by about, I'd missed my upper back by about 2 inches on my left side and probably about the same on the other side. I think he shot me left to right because the second one went a little wider, which means he was probably on the fly as he was doing it. But Joe was killed on the front lawn, and the cops came and arrested me and took me down to the police station.
You know, you called the cops when you escaped. How did they end up arresting you?
Well, because they got a call about a suspect in dark clothing, a male, and that was me. And so they arrested me, and
Was that your call that said dark clothing, or was that somebody else who called?
No, that was me.
So you described someone in dark clothing. They assumed it was you when they found you.
Uh-huh. I just kind of wandered into the middle of the street in shock, and I saw that our local plainclothes car, because I lived in a crack neighborhood, so you get to recognize all the plainclothes cars, and I saw this guy coming the wrong way up the street, so I started flagging him down, so I recognized his car. And he said, you know, the bullhorn came on and said, go to the side of the, you know, curb, put your hands on your head. I said, no, I'm the one who called you, you know, and I started shouting out my street address. And then they got mad. You know, they go to the side of the curb, and they came out, and they had their guns out, and they arrested me. I'm going, no, I'll take you to the place. Come on. And they're like, just get in the car and shut up. So
how was that resolved?
It wasn't. It was,
I mean, how did they release you?
Well, they released me 10 hours later. They kept me there overnight because I was the only witness, and I had to wait for the detectives to get back from the scene so I could give my report. You know, they could ask me, and I could, you know, give them a verbal statement of what I saw and what happened.
Were you still a suspect then?
Not really. It was never formally said, we think you did it. I mean, no one ever said, you killed Joe. But what the drag was is these detectives, they need a motive. They don't understand what the reason was why this happened. So they're going, okay, you guys must have been drug dealers. And, you know, the hardest core thing we ever did at that house was like, I think spinach noodles, you know? I mean, we're so lightweight. We were into working out and you know, eating pasta. And, you know, Joe didn't even drink coffee, you know? So that was totally out of the question. These guys hit me with, they would grill me for months about how Joe and I were coke dealers. It's like, fellas, you know, we're not coke dealers. It's just not an option there. Took them a while to get off that track.
Did you ever try to find the killers?
Me?
Well, I mean,
get on the public bus and go drive around Venice. Does anyone know anyone who killed anyone around here? No,
No, but you know what I mean? You can really kind of apply heat to the investigators to
Well, I know the two detectives who were on the case, and there's not a whole lot I can tell them about their job.
Yeah.
And I don't think, they called the other day. They're still on it.
They are.
These guys are really good, and they're really cool people. I don't mind these two detectives, even though they are cops. You know, and I don't think any cop can be trusted, but these guys are definitely into nailing this guy. They're still on it. They called my manager the other day. And so I can't, I mean, I give them every, you know, whenever they say, hey, can you call us in, you know, I guess they're not used to having witnesses be all that cooperative. They said I'm the most cooperative witness they've ever had. Because I give them my tour schedule. I give them all my phone numbers. I go, you know, tell me the day you need me. I'll call you. You know, or if I'm in L.A., I'm going to be in L.A. from here to here. when you need me, call me. I'll go down, look at pictures, you know. You want me to take a polygraph test, and I got nothing to hide, so I said, anytime, anywhere.
You don't still live in a crack neighborhood, do you?
Yeah, I do, because I live in L.A., and L.A. has turned into one big crack neighborhood, unfortunately. I'm not trying to be all dramatic, but I live in Hollywood now, and Hollywood used to be just kind of dirty, you know, where you just didn't want to get any on you. But now my neighborhood, Central Hollywood, has turned into definitely a crack neighborhood. All these Crips have come up from South Central because there's no gangs in Hollywood, and so there's no one really running the streets as far as drug trade. So these guys have a wide open market. So now I got guys on my corner everywhere I go, and they're scary too, really scary guys.
So you must still feel pretty vulnerable in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I feel vulnerable everywhere I go due to the recognition factor, which is kind of unnerving. But in that neighborhood, I don't like going out of my own place after 2 in the morning.
Well, do you think that you're more protected or less protected when you're recognized?
Well, when you get recognized by someone, they always have the jump on you. They know who you are. I don't know who they are. You know, I don't know what they want to do. You know, I don't know when some guy's going to go, hey, you, and they'll hand me a pen and a piece of paper, or they'll be sticking a gun on my face. I don't know. You know, and it's not always pleasant just walking down the street trying to, you know, think about something and just have all of a sudden some guy has his arm around you. He's run up from behind you and have your heart leap up into your throat. And it's like this guy is running, put up his arm around you and going, God, I can't believe it's you. You're like, hey, you know, you shouldn't come up on someone's back like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, take care, and thank you very, very much for doing the interview.
Okay, see ya.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Henry Rollins, his spoken word performances, The Boxed Life, are distributed by Imago Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.